This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Godless heathens and irreverent infidels. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This show, as you know, if you're a regular listener, is produced by the National Freedom From Religion Foundation. We are the country's largest organization of freethinkers, atheists and agnostics, and religious skeptics, and the none of the aboves who don't believe the Bible, don't believe in God, but we do believe in knowledge and reason and science and morality and love and family and all of those things.
And the First Amendment.
And the First Amendment, because one of our major purposes at the foundation is to protect the First Amendment, to work, and we'll hear a little bit more about that on our show today, to keep
the wall of separation between church and state intact.
Exactly.
On today's show, we'll be interviewing Chris Mooney. He's one of the authors of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And he's written many other books and articles, including an article this month for Salon.com called Why America is Flunking Science.
Because the math is so hard. Is that why? Well, we'll have to ask Chris about that. Last week on the show, we reported on the Freedom From Religion Foundation's newest federal lawsuit. And if you remember, Congress hastily passed a law.
A resolution
requiring that the architect, and there's actually an architect in the legislature, that the architect
of the Capitol,
Visitor Center, change the design and insert In God We Trust and the Religious Pledge of Allegiance into the Capitol Visitor Center, which just opened last December. And we're challenging the constitutionality of that and the legality of that and the expenditure of some of our tax dollars on that.
It would cost minimum about $100,000. And as we said last week, if you want to go to the Capitol, if you want to see your member of Congress in the Capitol, everybody is being routed through the visitors' center. So this is high profile. And they want this to be prominently engraved. And I'm assuming they mean by that, like, huge over the entrance or on top of the building, someplace outside. And it was a religious right coup where they had a hissy fit because they said there wasn't any God at the visitor center, explaining that our country is founded on God and Christianity, and therefore this had to be added. And so we brought that lawsuit in federal court, and there's been a lot of tension on the lawsuit since it was filed. And
a lot of national stories, and we've done a whole bunch of radio and print interviews.
And one of the media that you did last week, Dan, was a national Fox News TV coverage, and they made you get up very early to do Fox and Friends. What time was that recorded?
I had to be at the station at 5 a.m. For their Eastern 6:20 time show, which was 3 or 4 minutes long.
So you can listen and see if you think Dan was awake.
Is it an unconstitutional endorsement of religion or a national motto that should be properly displayed on government buildings? For instance, right there, you can see In God We Trust in the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, a lawsuit has been filed to keep In God We Trust from being engraved on the Capitol Visitor Center that just opened in Washington, D.C. The center is the entrance for tourists visiting the U.S. Capitol. Dan Barker is co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They filed the complaint. He joins us from Madison, Wisconsin, and in our D.C. Bureau, Colby May, senior attorney at the American Center for Law and Justice. Dan, let's start with you. You can see In God We Trust in the Supreme Court. You can see it in the U.S. House, throughout Congress. Why should it not be in the Capitol Visitor Center?
That motto says In God We Trust, but there are millions, there are tens of millions of really good Americans who don't believe in a God. So how in the world can a secular democracy be dictating the private religions of its citizens. Okay. That should not be on our money. It should not be in the Capitol. It should not be displayed on any official government property.
Right.
Private citizens are free to promote it themselves, but we are a secular, pluralistic, democratic nation.
And in fact, your organization is trying to scrub God off of the money and off of buildings and all sorts of places. Colby, why do you think he is wrong?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, and the lower courts have ruled almost universally for the last 40 years that inspirational patriotism is not the same as religious exercise. And so things like the national motto, under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, all of these references are appropriate in the context of recognizing a kind of inspirational patriotism, and they are not in violation of the Establishment Clause. So this pogrom continues to try and eliminate all references to God in the country, but in fact the courts have sustained it as being appropriate.
Dan, I'll give you a 20-second rebuttal.
Well, the pogrom is the other direction. In God We Trust is not on the architecture of that visitor center. It is religious right legislators who are trying to force their private religious views on the rest of us by inserting and intruding that religious view that does not represent all Americans. If it would be wrong to exclude and offend Jews, why is it right to exclude and offend atheists?
All right, Colby, you get the final word on this.
Well, the idea that the offended observer will have standing to automatically go into court and now demand that one of national places make sure it doesn't have the national motto that's been around since the War of 1812, essentially, is rather surprising. And I think most Americans recognize it as being a kind of inspirational patriotism and not religious exercise.
All right. Well, we are talking about putting up a motto that at a visitor center where as you go into the Capitol, you wind up seeing it all over the walls. All right, good debate. Dan and Colby, we thank you very much for joining us live today.
Thank you.
So that imagery, Dan, and you did very well for 5:30 in the morning, that imagery of, you know, scrub clean and pogrom and, you know, like this is the Nazis.
Like we are the aggressors.
Yeah. Yeah. And the actual aggressors were, have always been the religious right lobby who've always been unhappy with the fact that we have a godless and secular constitution. And they refer to In God We Trust. It was in one of the later stanzas of the battle hymn of the, or, I'm sorry, the national anthem that was adopted.
Is that why Colby May said it's been around since 18?
Yes, that's why he said that.
It wasn't our motto then.
No, it wasn't a motto. It was just in a song, and it was a part of the song nobody sings. But it wasn't adopted as the motto until, now I can't remember if it was 55 or 56. And they also then said it had to be on all the money, and it didn't get on all the money currency until late 1957.
And only in a couple of the mints.
So and also Under God was added... tampered with, the Pledge of Allegiance was tampered with in 1954 as a direct result of the Knights of Columbus and ministerial campaigns that insisted we should have God in our government. But I think where they're wrong is that we have all kinds of records in the congressional record and websites showing that the agitators to insist that this had to be engraved at the visitor center are saying this is because we're a Christian nation. They ain't talking about a generic God. They're talking about a Christian God.
Some ceremonial deism that...
Yeah, is a phony ruse. And, well, anyway, the foundation's inbox has been overflowing.
I want to tell you something else first. A really fun interview I did was with Voice of America in Malaysia. A Chinese woman, not Malaysia, Mandarin, a Mandarin Voice of America, a Chinese woman called, and she just came over here, and she interviewed me, and she said, when I came to America, I thought everybody here was Christian. You mean there's some of you who are not? And she says, I'm an atheist, and she was really happy to be reporting about the activities of atheists in this country.
And you also did an interview with McClatchy News Service, and then that ran... in newspapers, more than 200 around the country last weekend. And as a result, our inboxes were overflowing when we came back to work on Monday, and an awful lot of crank mail, which really...
And telephone calls.
Which really slows us down. But our very hardworking office manager, Jackie, processed more than 200 new memberships that came in just that weekend, a weekend ago.
People who support our lawsuit and our activities.
And so thank you if you have recently joined FFRF, or if you contributed to the Foundation Legal Fund.
So what kind of crank mail were you getting?
Well, we got much of it we could not read over the air. The FCC would go after the license here, and we wouldn't want to do that. But what was amusing is that, well, they're all the same. I mean, some of them are lecturing and boring and earnest, telling you you're going to go to God and you need to find Jesus. But They all basically say something similar, which is that if you don't believe in God like I do, and if you don't like the motto, "In God We Trust," then get out. Go someplace else. Leave the country. They'll say, spend your money on a boat and ship out. And what's amusing is that all the different places they tell you to go.
Besides go to hell.
Yeah, they tell you to go to hell and use a lot of colorful language. But then they told us, well, we got one that said go to Russia, which is,
pretty common.
Pretty common.
Red
but then they said go to Siberia. Then we got one saying go to China. And then we got another one saying go to Iran.
And a horrible one, go to Canada.
Yeah, isn't that a terrible place to go? But I had never before gotten one of these nasty emails saying, why don't you go to Pakistan? So they're, they're funny, but they're quite telling. They make our case for us, and we plan to use crank mail, so send it on if you want,
because
as evidence
really,
in our lawsuit.
If the motto really is just this sort of tame, secular, ceremonial thing, then why are all these religious right people angry at
us? Well, it also shows, it makes our case that there's injury to those of us who do not believe in God, that we are actually disenfranchised, discriminated against, and treated like we are second-class citizens.
So we'll hear more about that on later shows. But right now, before we go to the break, we want to report that in May, the Sunday Reporter in the United Kingdom reported something interesting. The headline said, imagine that cathedral bells in Liverpool play Lennon's anti-religion hit. Churchmen in Liverpool say they carefully considered the sensitivities surrounding the lyrical content of the former Beatles' 1971 hit, which begins, imagine there's no heaven, before allowing the performance at the city's cathedral, which boasts the highest and heaviest ringing peal bells in the world. And the story goes on to say, hundreds of people gathered outside the cathedral to hear the tune, which John Lennon described as anti-religious, anti-conventional, and anti-capitalistic. And that story notes a team of six players practiced for 3 months. So as we go out, let's listen to a little bit of the cathedral bells playing Imagine. Slower. Well, that's John Lennon's Imagine. Yeah. People say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Use your imagination.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. We'll be back in a couple minutes to talk about famous freethinkers born in the month of July. And we invite you to stay tuned for the second half of the show and our conversation with author and science educator Chris Mooney, whose new book is called Unscientific America.
Hi, I'm Russ Bates, and from Bowling Green, Ohio, and I'm Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we're back, and now it's time for July's Freethinkers Almanac.
Very pretty little bit of music is played by Dan, and that's from the German anthem Friedgedanken sind frei. Well, we didn't want the month of July to pass without talking about the famous freethinkers born this month, and they include many freethinking authors, starting with Barbara G. Walker, author of the Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, whom we've had on our show. She was born in early July, July 2nd. The same day, it's Georges Sand, née Aurore Dupin. She was born in the year 1804. was a deistic, even pantheistic author, but she rejected what she called Christianity's anthropomorphic God. And so did her live-in, Chopin. He likewise refused to return to the Catholic Church. She was a very fascinating woman, and so was Charlotte Perkins Gilman, another woman of the century, born July 2nd, 1860. Prolific feminist writer, author, editor, poet, who wrote the very fascinating book, His Religion and Hers, A Study of the Faith of Our Founders and the Work of Our Mothers, in 1923.
And you can read all about her in Annie Laurie's book, Women Without Superstition. Other notable authors include Alexander Pushkin, Robert A. Heinlein, Marcel Proust, Henry David Thoreau, who famously said on his deathbed, "One world at a time." And did you know William Makepeace Thackeray regarded evangelical dogma, as he put it, rubbish? Thackeray was born July 18th, 1811, and wrote such satiric novels as Vanity Fair. The Heinlein quote, should I read that?
No, I don't think we have time, but the Freethinker revolutionaries born in this revolutionary month include Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was fittingly born on July 4th in 1807. He worked to emancipate Italy from outside rule and from the Vatican rule and rejected all creeds. Simon Bolivar was born July 24th, 1783. He became the first president of Bolivia and, of course, helped to liberate South America from the sway of Spanish priests. And who are some of the other authors, Dan, who were born in July?
Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, Camille Pissarro, Harrison Ford, the actor, director Ingmar Bergman, novelist Irish Murdoch, Tom Robbins, Stanley Kubrick, Aldous Huxley. Also of note, Eric Hoffer, whose first book, The True Believer, came out in 1951, is now a classic.
And we don't want to forget George Bernard Shaw, born July 26, 1856, highly irreverent. And we want to wish a happy birthday to one of our lifetime members at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Paul D. Boyer, who is turning 91 on July 1st and won the Nobel Prize with two other scientists back in 1997.
You can sign up for a daily calendar of this Freethinker's Almanac. It's called Free Thought of the Day. Go to FFRF.org or go to... or just look them up at FFRF.org if you want more details on the irreverent views of all these famous freethinkers.
And tune in, stay with us for Chris Mooney. We'll be right back.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at FFRF.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
If you don't believe in God, or if you have a problem with organized religion, there is a new radio show just for you. Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker, and Free Thought Radio's back.
And we have on the phone with us today from Chicago, Chris Mooney. Chris is at, I guess he's on a book tour for his brand new book, and we thank him for finding the time to speak with us. Chris Mooney is a contributing editor to Science Progress. He's author of the New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science, and Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming. He contributes to many publications, including Wired, Slate, and The American Prospect. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey.
And your newest book is called Unscientific America. Is that right, Chris Mooney?
Yep.
And when did that come out?
Well, just now, July, mid-July. And it's co-authored with a young marine scientist named Cheryl Kirschenbaum, with whom I also share a blog at Discover Magazine called The Intersection.
I loved your previous book about the Bush's war on science. And I just finished Unscientific American. And the subtitle of your book is called How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. So how does scientific illiteracy threaten our future?
Well, just to put it briefly, it leaves us too ill-attuned to the developments in science that are going to shape policy decisions 10, 20, 30 years hence, and also the centrality of scientific innovation to the growth of our economy and basically to our prosperity. If people don't have science on the radar, then they're not going to be ready to grapple with the sort of science controversies 2.0 after stem cells and global warming have finally gone away. You know, people are going to be surprised, shocked, alarmed by what science brings rather than ready to sort of have a sober societal discussion about what to do about it.
Now, I have to say I haven't read your book yet, although Dan has. When you're talking about scientific illiteracy, is that in part this huge number, I think it's over 50% now, of adult Americans who say that they accept creationism and reject evolution?
Yeah, that's certainly one part of it. I mean, so there's the facts of science, and Americans, you know, get them wrong when you quiz them on it. There's scientific method. You know, Americans are not that great at that either. There's another aspect, which is just how attuned are Americans to the importance of science, to society, to their future. How relevant do Americans see it to their lives? And in some ways, I think that's the most important. But we're not doing good on any of these measures, and I can rattle off various alarming figures for you.
Well, sure.
Yeah, well, you know, you say that the anti-evolution figure, and depending on how the polling question is done, it can be different. It can vary, but Gallup does it the way they do it. They get 46% of Americans are not only anti-evolution, but they believe the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. So, in other words, they're young Earth creation.
Yeah, that is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, nearly half the country, according to the Gallup question. And there's many other science questions. So you ask people, you know, they can't get right, about 50% can't get right that the Earth rotates around the sun, takes a year to do it. And so just imagine, and almost nobody can explain why the seasons changed then.
But that's pretty amazing, though, how the Creator made the Earth take exactly 1 year to go around. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Whatever you attribute it to, they can't get the facts.
They can't even get that part. Yeah.
We had on our show last week Ben Bova, the science fiction writer and big proponent of science, who told us that some of the books that he wrote 10, 20 years ago, that which were science fiction, are now no longer science fiction. Science is accelerating at such a rate that it can be pretty scary to the world.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly why, you know, if people don't have science on the radar and suddenly Craig Venter creates a synthetic minimal genome organism, people are going to be shocked and alarmed. But, of course, scientists know this is coming. Or, you know, scientists who specialize in climate change are talking seriously now about whether we're going to have to geoengineer the stratosphere if global warming is getting out of
control. I think that would be a good idea.
if we know the outcome.
Yeah, if we know what we're doing.
Yeah, well, we don't. But we might have to if the problem is that bad. It might be the only option we have. So how will the world respond? I can guarantee you that it's only the tiniest sliver of a percent of Americans who have ever heard of geoengineering.
Now, you write in your book that the illiteracy and the lack of knowledge with it is just a small part of the problem. The real problem, you and Cheryl Kirshenbaum, who is a practicing science, you point out that there's this huge rift between science and culture. And by culture, you identify the media, politics, entertainment, and religion. So why is there that rift, and how can we make science more relevant? How can we bridge that rift?
Yeah, well, we analyze the problem, and what we try to do is, you know, clearly the public doesn't know as much about science as it should, but we try to not just point fingers and say, you know, the public is ignorant, because I don't think that gets at the whole problem. We think it's more productive to analyze it as a gap between the public and scientists, and more specifically between scientists and those four sectors of society that are very influential that you mentioned, the politicians, the media, the entertainers, the religious leaders and the religious followers. And by doing it that way, by looking at why science doesn't get through to these people, we can then see that it turns out that there are a lot of problems on, say, the politician side, but also scientists don't necessarily know how to talk to politicians. There's huge problems on the media side where science is vanishing from the media, but also scientists are not very equipped to handle the media, and scientists don't award those within their ranks who excel at communication. In fact, sometimes they'll punish those within their ranks who excel at communication.
Well, someone like Carl Sagan, of course, felt very strongly that he needed to reach the public.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not really a Carl Sagan-esque figure right now, is there?
Right, there's not. And also Sagan, you know, a lot of scientists were unhappy mm-hmm. with Sagan. So we use that episode to show how it's not that, you know, scientists aren't, you know, at fault here. We've got a society where there's, you know, there's a media that doesn't convey much information about science. There's a poor education system. There's religious dogma that gets in the way of science. There's politicians who twist science. But scientists are also in the equation. And part of the book is sort of an exhortation to scientists to say, you know what, you guys, not only can you do more, you're probably the ones who best know what needs to happen, given that you're aware of the information, at least when America isn't. And it might fall to you to have to do this outreach to the rest of society, because, look, nobody else is doing it.
Well, and they're also going to benefit from an increased public acceptance of science in our public policies.
Oh, absolutely, and also maybe in their funding levels. So, you know, there's many incentives to do it, and so it's part of saying, you know, stop just being annoyed when the media gets it wrong or when the politicians get it wrong, and start saying, what can I do about this problem? And that, I think, is the message that we're certainly finding, that when we go and talk to young scientists on university campuses, they really, really dig that message. There's a whole new generation of people in science who want to not just be a researcher. They want to be someone who talks to the media, someone who, you know, goes into a community and explains science to ordinary Americans.
Do you think it's getting better now that Bush's war on science is over and we have Obama?
Well, we solved the political problem of science in Washington that was just egregious misbehavior by the last administration, you know, suppressing information, rewriting scientific reports, not letting scientists speak to the media, all this just flagrant wrongdoing and violation of the integrity of information. I mean, that is deliberately being addressed by the Obama administration as part of their policy. So we don't have to worry about that kind of, you know, really, really beyond the pale behavior. But we still have, you know, an American public that's not very engaged with science. So we still have, you know, deep cultural problems that you can't just fix by fixing Washington.
Well, and is there anything, do you have a list for Obama if you had a wish list in the science aspect?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would love to. So the good thing about the Obama administration is on policy matters that we fought over during the whole Bush years, I think that they're really taking a better approach on stem cells, for example. They're liberating a lot of stem cell research. They're giving a lot of new money to the scientific community for research. It's very important. I certainly agree that their stance on climate change is better. But if I could go farther, what I would highlight is we need more government programs that are not only funding scientific research, but that are also training people in science to be the next generation of ambassadors to the rest of American society. So there's fledgling programs at places like the National Science Foundation, like the IGERT program, which is sort of interdisciplinary, funding of interdisciplinary education for scientists. They exist, but they don't have a lot of money. They're sort of young and not really as big as they could be. And I think this is the kind of stuff we need to beef up so we can have a generation of scientists that are not only excelling at research, but are also helping America see why science is so important.
We heard last year about that Science Debate 2008 campaign, which was trying to bring a science debate into the campaign. Were you a part of that, and was it all that effective, or what was the outcome of all of that?
We tell the story of this in the book, and my co-author Cheryl and I were actually the co-founders, among the co-founders. There was a small group that included Lawrence Krauss, the celebrity physicist, and two screenwriters, Matthew Chapman and Sean Lawrence Otto.
And Matthew is the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin.
That's right. Yeah, he's just a great guy. And this was his brainchild. He, more than anyone else, made it exist. And then Sean Otto, more than anyone else, actually ran it day-to-day. So I think it was both a success and a failure. It's a failure if you say, did it achieve the goal that it wanted to, which was a nationally televised debate about science policy between the presidential candidates. And obviously that didn't happen, or you would have seen it. but it succeeded in the sense that it rallied tens of thousands of people who care about science behind a cause, and that infrastructure is going to still be there for the next election.
We're talking with Chris Mooney, who, with Cheryl Kirshenbaum, authors the new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And we'll be back to talk with Chris after this break.
My name is Susan from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker, and we're back with our guest, Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America. And Chris, some of your book talks about the pendulum swings since the end of World War II. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened, you know, in the post-war, and especially the post-Sputnik era, is that American society rallied around science based on the vision that it was central to what we needed to achieve as a people. And, of course, we were spurred on a lot by the fact that the Soviets had put Sputnik up there, and we were a little scared that they were so far ahead of us. And so, you know, Congress unleashed tons of funding for scientific research, created key scientific agencies like NASA and the National Science Foundation, created careers in science for a lot of the researchers that are now the senior scientists today, invested in high school education, and many, many other things were done to ramp up our ability in science. And the investments made then gave us the great scientific establishment that we have today.
And we kids were shooting rockets in the backyard, you know.
Exactly.
It was an exciting time.
Absolutely. And, you know, and clearly kids are not doing that today. Something happened. Something changed. And we try to trace in the book. It's certainly complicated. Science became embroiled in the political battles of the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, to some extent, science fell off its pedestal as it was associated with, you know, environmental degradation and corporate corruption. And all kinds of things happened, you know, basically taking us to our present moment. And the book argues, it traces that story, and it argues that, you know what, science matters just as much as it did in the post-Sputnik era, maybe more. And it doesn't matter if, whether or not we have a common enemy to rally around, you know, like we did, you know, we're trying to get ahead of the Soviets. We need to be just as science-centered now as we were then.
You know, when I was in elementary school, science for the little kids, you know, is always like fun. If you go to a bookstore in the kids section, you see all these dinosaurs and fossils and spaceships. And we tell these little kids, isn't it fun to learn about science? And it is. But then when you get in high school, suddenly something flips or, you know, suddenly science becomes like hard work and oh, who wants to do that? Is the educational system a little part of the problem we're facing?
Oh, a big part of the problem. I mean, you know, I experienced this personally. I was a good student, but I didn't learn a thing in science in high school. All I did was memorize. And I was super good at memorizing, so I got good grades. And I felt like, you know, haha, I'm beating the system. Because that was all you had to do. You know, it wasn't learning. And unfortunately, too many kids in high school get turned off by just the humdrum, you know, body of facts approach.
And maybe they think the math is too hard or...
Well, the math is imposing, but it's also just, you know, science is a lot of memorization, you know, memorize parts of the cell, memorize the periodic table, all that kind of stuff. And what's missing is the big picture. Why does this matter?
So what would be your plan to revamp science education?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I don't have a complete plan, but I would say that what's lacking is the part that makes students inspired. And so I think what you need is you need real inspiring scientists to be coming to the classroom. And you need to be teaching science in contexts that resonate for kids of today. So one great idea out there that is being taught on the college level that I know of is actually, you know, the physics of film, where you get Hollywood films and you show, you know, how science is depicted in them, and then you can show what's wrong with it and show how the real science would go. But you watch the movies and then you analyze them scientifically. Things like that that would really get people, I think, more engaged and would get away from some of the problems with memorization.
At the end of your book, you talk about this rift, you know, between science and culture, whatever the level of culture is, and that scientists themselves have just as much of a responsibility to try to bridge that gap. But I love what you said at the end. Science is not merely culture's essential component. We don't just have to mend the rift between science and culture. We have to create a perfect union. Science itself must become the common culture. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, you know, if my admittedly idealistic vision can be realized, then finally there will be a body of facts, a body of information that we all share and that we agree on its importance. So, you know, I mean, this is blue sky, right? But, you know.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, our country lags so far behind the other countries when they did that famous survey on attitudes on evolution. Mm-hmm. There were some like 35 Western countries, and we were at the bottom with Turkey. I don't think it's too much to think that we could turn our country's ignorance around on evolution.
Yeah, it would be, but it's a huge project. I mean, you know, we say in the book, you know, we can finally rest when it's only 20% young Earth creationists. But how are you going to get, even getting there, you know, that is it.
I think you're right. It's PR. Scientists and evolutionists have to do some PR and quit apologizing, I guess, for knowing the facts.
But the disconnect is that even though America lags way back in public understanding, America's still the world leader in actual scientific progress and knowledge.
For the moment.
Yeah. But it won't last, will it?
Well, you know, the way things are looking, some people in science are certainly very scared looking in that rearview mirror and saying, well, that's China. It's coming up really, really fast. And we may honestly not be able to ever have as many scientists as China, given the much larger population.
But don't an awful lot of people send their students to this country to be educated in science, but then they go back to their countries?
Yeah, well, some stay. I mean, we've clearly got the best science education establishment, the best universities, and there's a lot of ways in which we are ahead.
And it's not really the university level where we have a problem. It's really the high school level, isn't it?
For education in science, mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, at the university level in the book, we argue that there's a different problem, and that is the problem of creating only one kind of scientist.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us, Chris Mooney. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker, and we appreciate you being part of the show. And your book, Unscientific America, is widely available, I presume. And do you have a website?
Unscientificamerica.com.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you, Chris.
Thank you both.
Go to our website to hear this show, podcast, and listen to the archives at ffrf.org/radio.
And you can join us there at ffrf.org or call 1-800-335-4021 and request a sample issue of our newspaper and other information. We'd be very glad to send it to you. We'd be glad to hear from friendly people after all the crank mail we've been inundated with last week. And if you're a regular listener, we do encourage you to get involved. Join FFRF, go to Facebook, go to our forum, and we'll be back next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.